Coming up today, encryption in the age of terror, the security behind the new £1 coin, and we head to Berlin to explore what London's post-Brexit startup scene stands to lose. You're listening to episode 311 of the WideUK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me today are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And no one else.
I know.
We're all alone.
What's happened?
Everyone either has the day off or doesn't have time for the podcast, which is an outrage. But we're here, dear listeners.
It's going to be intimate.
It's going to be very intimate. We should start off by saying that Wide has been nominated for quite a few awards, which we're very excited about and very honoured to be shortlisted for. So the British Society of Magazine Editors, which is a bit like the magazine Oscars, I like to think. So our art and picture desks have both been nominated in their relevant categories. Jeremy has been nominated as Best Section for Gear, which is the product section. Oliver Franklin Wallace has been nominated for Best Magazine Writer. And Greg Williams, our editor, has been nominated for Best Feature for his story about a big cocaine bust on a ship in Scotland. We'll find out how well we do in a few weeks.
Hopefully it won't be like the Oscars when they open the wrong thing and give it to us by mistake, or give it to somebody else by mistake.
No dramas. I don't want any dramas. So it'll be a fun night and we'll let you know how we do. Matt, what did you learn this week?
I have learned that there is now an internet-connected flip-flop.
No. There can't be.
There really is.
I mean, it's April Fool's pretty soon. Tomorrow, in
it
fact.
It is, yes. But this is not. This is not one. This came out before that. So this week there was a Internet of Things flip-flop that was announced, which has a NFC chip in it, which basically connects to your phone. And the company that has done this has done it so they can get some data on users, really, or wearers. And it's because when people buy stuff online, they get their home address, they get their email address, loads of information to sell further products and do marketing with, basically. But because you don't get that when you buy something in a shop, they put a chip into the flip-flop.
So the idea being that I'm going to buy a flip-flop and then...
Download an app,
tap my phone onto my flip-flop, and then give them all my personal information.
Pretty much, yeah.
Good luck. I learned that what the X in X-ray stands for, and it's really great because it stands for nothing. So German physicist Wilhelm Röntgen, who discovered the form of radiation in 1895, had no idea what it was, so he called it X radiation.
Oh, wow. So it's like... when you don't know what a number is and you call it N in mathematics.
Yep, he just called it X because he had no idea what it was that he discovered.
So or Homer Simpson in The Simpsons being called Homer J. Simpson.
The J stands for J. Yeah. Very good reference. Swiftly on to our first story. WhatsApp has been making a lot of headlines this week. Following the attack on Westminster, in which three people were killed, the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, has said it is completely unacceptable that security services are not able to read messages that are protected by end-to-end encryption, such as what WhatsApp uses. These comments were made on a big political TV program here in the UK on Sunday morning, and led to some fairly frowned faces within the technology industry, but some fairly alarmist headlines from the mainstream press. So it's been a bit of a mess.
It has. I think some of the newspapers on Monday morning here, because these comments were made on Sunday, so about a week ago now, were saying WhatsApp, the friend of terrorists, or some along those lines, basically.
Yeah, I think a couple of the headlines were that WhatsApp was hiding as they call it, terrorists' final messages. So this was Khalid Massoud, who drove the car into some people on Westminster Bridge and then into Houses of Parliament. Allegedly, he accessed WhatsApp a couple of minutes before he started his attack. And this is what's gotten Home Secretary Amber Rudd quite so excited. What's slightly odd here, and we were talking about this earlier in the week, Matt, is how would the security services know that he accessed WhatsApp?
Well, they've presumably got his phone now because obviously he's dead, and they would have like collected this and looked at it and tried to get into it just access the phone. But that's a completely different issue and a different problem. But what we figured, and what I think other people have as well, is that somebody saw that he was active on WhatsApp. So when you use it, it says so-and-so James looked at his WhatsApp or was active on here using the platform at a certain time. And that was around the same sort of time where this attack happened. That's basically what we can gather through this. But, well, do you want to do the really, really obvious thing and explain why the Home Secretary is so wrong?
Yes. So what she called for is effectively backdoors to be introduced into end-to-end encryption and going specifically after WhatsApp. But the reason that I wanted to explain that is there's a slight contradiction here between what security services have said and what Amber Rudd has said. So they've said that he accessed WhatsApp. That doesn't mean that he sent or received a message. It just means that likely someone has shared with them information that says he last accessed WhatsApp a couple of minutes before the attack. So there's that problem to begin with. And as you say, they've probably got his physical device, which will be a different problem for them to unlock that if they need to. Or if they want to. Well, they of course they do. Yes. So Amber Rudd said that backdoors should be introduced into end-to-end encryption. For those that don't understand the technology, a very simple way of explaining end-to-end encryption with regards WhatsApp or any other service that uses it is think of it as a tunnel. And on either end of the tunnel, there is a locked door. And when you send a message on WhatsApp, you use a key to open your door, send the message down the tunnel, and at the other end, someone uses their key to open the door at the other end and take the message. All the while in between, no one can look at the message. And if they do try to, because it's encrypted and the key decrypts it, it's garbage. It's completely garbled nonsense gibberish. No one can read your messages that you send via WhatsApp. Not WhatsApp, not the CIA, not the FBI, not GCHQ, not anyone, apart from the person you send it to.
So your tunnel is made of granite or something ridiculously thick that you basically can't get through.
I mean, you can get through, but what you get out will just be gibberish. So what the Home Secretary...
You'll be in the dark, like you're in a tunnel.
Yes, and you can hear people speaking a language you don't understand and could never understand without a key. It's maths, and you can't break maths. So when the Home Secretary was making these comments, she compared it to some previous techniques that security services might have used under warrant, such as steaming open envelopes. It's a good example. It is what they used to do and presumably what they still do in some instances when they have a warrant to tap someone's communications. They can go after phone calls, text messages, internet history, or they can steam open an envelope. To steam open an envelope, all you have to do is make glue break. To break encryption, and that just makes that envelope weak, if you like. To break encryption on WhatsApp, to go after one person, the problem is that you then break it for everyone. So once you introduce what we call a backdoor, which is effectively you introduce a fundamental flaw into a piece of encryption technology, it then means that when I'm sending a message to you, when an MP is sending a message to another MP, when anyone is using WhatsApp to communicate, that anyone with the right knowledge could intercept that communication and read it. And that anyone could include a foreign government, a terrorist organization, a crime syndicate, anyone. You can't introduce a security backdoor for the British security surveillance services without it also being available to everyone else who's clever enough to find it.
Exactly. And it's worth saying as well that if somebody could introduce a backdoor into end-to-end encryption, well, you can't. You fundamentally can't. If you did introduce one, it wouldn't be end-to-end encryption anymore because it's not encrypted at either ends of the tunnel, to use your metaphor.
Yes, so it's annoying in that it shows that the Home Secretary doesn't have an understanding of how these technologies work, which, to my thinking, and I've been thinking about this quite a bit this week, we've been asked to do quite a lot of commentary in the press to help explain the technical issues. It's fine for her to not understand it, but she's quite confrontational in her approach. So she's not showing a willingness to go and understand it. So she spoke about understanding the necessary hashtags and spoke about the cloud as if it was something that you refer to in air quotes. And it was quite garbled. It was quite misinformed. The interview didn't really give you a good sense of what she wanted to achieve. All it did was created this further divide between the government and the security services and the technology companies that they really need to cooperate with in order to deal with some of these issues. And we just end up with a divide, with a confrontation, and nothing gets done.
Yeah, that's really the case. And for me, one of the big things around this is showing that politicians don't really know, aren't briefed properly on the policies and the things that they're trying to make. And there probably needs to be a better communication between the technology companies and the technologists and the people who are rightfully in favour of having private communications and way to communicate and those that are making policies. And like, I imagine the Home Secretary's got a very difficult job. She has to look after policing. She has to look after terrorist incidents. She has to look after a lot more than that as well. And there's no way that you expect somebody to understand the really fine granular details of about how end-to-end encryption works, or how, I don't know, like a policeman's truncheon works or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a case of, there needs to be this better dialogue between the two to just say, this is something that can't be this can't be done. And she's called in technology companies to speak about this. And what was the backlash as well? Or was there a backlash?
Yeah. So after an awful lot of the quite inaccurate headlines, and we should say that this was a hugely, hugely tragic incident, and that real things do need to happen as a result of it, that it can't just be empty statements and threats made by politicians and non-action by technology companies. Things do need to change. But the UK already has some of the most sweeping and powerful technology surveillance laws in the democratized world. They were passed after quite a bit of open debate following the Edward Snowden revelations. They were passed earlier this year. The Snoopers Charter, which is now the Investigatory Powers Bill or Act?
Act, because
Act,
it's in force.
It's been passed.
And there is a section in there which covers encryption, which actually gives a legal power for the authorities in the UK to say something should be, they should be able to access encrypted communications, which with end-to-end encryption, it obviously isn't possible, but there is this legal power already in place, which hasn't been used yet. And it'll be interesting to see if it does get used because of, well, political reasons.
Yes, and before we get on to what Amber Rudd and the technology companies got up to at their meeting on Thursday afternoon, what we should say is we've been here before. After the Charlie Hebdo attacks on Paris in 2015, I think it was, then Prime Minister David Cameron said that, again, that end-to-end encryption offered people a place to hide and that it was unacceptable. This kind of language has oft been repeated. But what will happen if WhatsApp were to say, okay, we'll get rid of encryption on our service, people will just go to another one. And you end up just playing a game of whack-a-mole. It's presuming that it's an incredibly difficult task to set up an encrypted messaging service. It's not particularly hard. I mean, there are plenty of them. And people just jump to the next one that they want to use if they want to keep the communications private. And maybe the vast majority of people that don't care will be happy to use WhatsApp, even though it doesn't have encryption. And that's kind of the point, that if you've got something to hide, you're going to try and hide it.
Exactly, yeah. And there's plenty of technologies to do this. And
yes.
Yeah, it will just keep doing that, and that's part of the thing. But it doesn't, because somebody has got something to hide, it doesn't mean that everybody else should be exposed.
Yes, this is the argument. So on Thursday afternoon, as I just said, Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary here in the UK, held a meeting with Google, Facebook, Twitter and Microsoft to discuss some of these points. But curiously, what they didn't discuss, seemingly, based on what Amber Rudd put out as a statement and what the companies put out as a statement, was encryption. Instead, they talked about making their platforms a hostile space for terrorists, and that all the companies were committed to this, but neither Rudd nor the companies made any mention of encryption, nor did they explain why it wasn't discussed. So essentially what you had was a meeting about the possibility of future meetings that was very much centered around the idea that an awful lot of terrorist propaganda is shared online. Sometimes it isn't removed quickly enough and isn't detected intelligently enough. And that the technology companies, as these platforms for distribution, need to do more to ensure that this kind of material can't proliferate. Labour's Yvette Cooper, who is Shadow Home Secretary, described the outcome of the meeting as a bit lame, which, to my interpretation, seems kind of fair, because it didn't really appear to achieve anything. The Guardian reports that Rudd will hold a separate discussion on the issue of encryption, and Apple reportedly refused to attend the meeting as encryption was not on the agenda this time. So a lot of hot air, a lot of noise, a lot of misinformation, and we didn't necessarily get anywhere, which in the wake of such serious events as what happened in Westminster is none.
No, exactly. And there's probably going to be a bit more on this space, but I think the government will probably want to distance itself from some of those comments, which is probably why it wasn't brought up in this meeting.
Yeah, so, and will we hear, when they have this meeting about encryption, will we hear the outcome of that kind of meeting? Because you can maybe imagine how it would go. We need a backdoor into end-to-end encryption. You can't have one. End.
And then the cycle starts again.
Yes, yes. So we'll be keeping an eye on it, and we'll let you know when there's something else that's worth knowing. Our second story this week, Cash Money, the new £1 coin here in the UK, Have you got one yet?
No, I haven't seen one at all. Have you?
I don't think I've spent any cash money since they introduced it on Tuesday, Wednesday, sometime this week. When was that?
A couple of days ago.
A couple of days ago. It's all a bit of a blur. So, yes, we have a new £1 coin here in the UK, which is terribly exciting. I think it's one of our highest trafficking stories this week. So there's a lot of interest in the new £1 coin. Tell us some more about it, Matt.
So for those not in the UK, the £1 coin is our second largest coin after the, well, in terms of value, after the £2 coin. And there are 1.5 billion of them in circulation at the moment. And the one we've got currently, or has just sort of started to be replaced, is about a centimetre wide. It's a small gold coin, has a picture of the Queen's face on, has something else on the other side, which differs on depending on the coin's year and when it was actually introduced and events that were going on around there. So this has been replaced with a new 12-sided coin, which is sort of hexagonal, but I don't know what the 12-sided equivalent for that is.
Nope, carry on.
No, so there's 12 sides, and it's got two different metals. There's a metal in the middle and a sort of different outer ring, which are just, yeah, different. They are
silver in the middle, gold around the edge.
Yes, and there's a hologram on it, or a sort of hologram, which is called a latent image. So if you look at it from a different angle, there's a slightly different image that goes into your eye and that you can see. And it's basically a bit thinner, it's slightly lighter. And the reason why this has been introduced is because we've had the old coin for about 30 years now, and there are 2% of the coins that are in circulation, £1 coins that are in circulation, are apparently fakes. So they can quite easily be faked. Like, I'm sure, James, you've had one which is fake in the coming years. I think
everybody has.
Very likely.
Yeah. So, sorry, you said there are how many in circulation? 1.8 billion?
1.5 billion.
1.5 billion, and 2% of those are fakes.
Yes.
Which I can't do the maths on that, but that's a lot of money.
I've seen around £45 million. So, 45 million coins that are potentially fakes, and they're obviously created for the purposes of crime and extorting money, and
yep,
obviously to get people rich off fake money.
So the reason for introducing the new one is it's a lot harder to fake, or as one of the people that worked on it told you, it is impossible to fake.
Yeah, so Gordon Summers, who is the chief engraver of the Royal Mint, which is the company that produces the all the coins in the UK, and actually produces coins for 40 different countries around the world and makes around 29 billion coins a year, I think. He said that this is one of the first big innovations in coin technology and coin security in particular in the last 30 years. And he said he's been in this business for 20 years, so he knows what he's on about.
Just to stop you there, what an amazing job. You often wonder, how do you become the chief engraver for the Royal Mint?
I think you have to be very good with lasers these days.
That makes sense, yeah. And the lasers here are super interesting. So the amount of detail that's on the new £1 coin compared to the old one, if anyone's got one in their pocket right now, I encourage you, take it out and have a look from the pictures that we've seen. Not that I've had one in my hand yet, unfortunately. Is that the engraving on the old £1 coin is quite chunky, is quite... there's not a lot of detail. The new one, as you say, they're able to create this sort of faux holographic effect of different images appearing because the engraving is so, so precise. And it's ridiculously expensive engraver. They're the first minter in the world to use them.
Yeah.
So you're making the sort of barrier of entry to counterfeiters way more complicated and way more expensive.
Yeah, and that's the big thing with the whole coin. They don't want people to counterfeit this. And all the different things that they've introduced with this laser, which is around £500,000, they said, and they're the first mint to be using this, although it's now available slightly more widely. They can make really fine, specific marks. The size of it, the shape of it, the weight of it, the different types of engravings around the edge. So around the edge of the coin, there's some tiny little lines which go in certain directions. Are all made to make sure that this coin can't be replicated. So the big combination of lots of different things. And then there's also this high security element to it, which they haven't really told us that much about because they obviously don't want it to be replicated so people can do this. But apparently the Royal Mint is the first people using this technique on coins in the world. It's been used on banknotes already. It's something that you can't see. It's basically something within the coin that can be scanned. Now, I don't know what that is. I don't know whether it's a chip. I don't know if it's a type of metal. I really don't know. Tell anybody, but it's something that they said is the first time it's been used in coins and is really just there to make this coin at the moment, according to them, impossible to replicate.
it's super intriguing, isn't it? That obviously they won't say what it is because then they'd be giving the game away. And it remains to be seen if it will be impossible to replicate. And I guess maybe it might take some of the big criminal organizations that work on these sort of projects a little while to give it a crack. And we'll maybe hear a little bit about that once they do start arriving on the market. But correct me if I'm wrong, there's a collector's item kind of thing going on here to do with an incorrectly dated coin.
Yeah, so a load of these coins in their production, because they've been under development for quite a few years, the process of creating them and the sort of politics behind it and all the policy making and the sort of decisions that had to be made have been going on for several years, I think. But in the mix of all of that, there was a batch of coins that was produced in 2016 or stamped with the date 2016 on, and obviously this coin is now in force in or coming out in 2017, so this batch with the old date on is turning into a bit of a collector's item, I think.
Tremendously exciting to people that collect coins, I'm sure. So they've been distributed to a number of post offices around the country, so people that wanted to go and get them immediately could, but the idea is that they sort of start to trickle out into regular circulation. And we had the introduction of a new polymer £5 note. All of our notes previously were more or less made of paper. This is plasticky. That was a few months ago, and it only took me maybe a couple of weeks and I was handed one as change at a pub. So it's remarkable how quickly these things get out there. How long is the old coin still legal for? Because I got a bunch in a jar at home.
Ooh, don't spend them all at once. But you have until October the 15th this year to spend them, and that's when they stop becoming legal tender. There's 300 million of the new coins out on the first day, so it probably won't be that long until you get one. But I think that there are still some places that aren't fully set up for them, sort of vending machines. Apparently 85% in the country can handle the new shape, but not all of them, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And Tesco's crucially has unlocked its trolleys. So putting the little pound coin in so you can go and do your weekly shop will still be possible while they upgrade, I guess, their systems for the new pound coin. Exciting coin news. Thank you, Matt. We'll go straight on to another story that you didn't report this week, but Jeremy did. As with everyone, Jeremy isn't around today. So the task falls to you to explain to us why we should all care about Samsung's new phone.
So I think we all remember Samsung's last phone, the one that caught fire. All of them caught fire, but some of them exploded.
It caused Samsung an absolute PR nightmare.
Yeah, and actually this week they said that they're going to start reselling refurbished units of that in certain places around the world. And if they can't resell them, they're going to take all the old parts like the cameras and stuff and actually put them into different phones and different applications and stuff in the future. So that's their plan with that. But in bigger news for the company and for everybody else, they've released or unveiled their first big phones following that failure last year, and this is the Samsung S8 and the Samsung S8 Plus.
What companies refer to these kind of phones are flagships. So this is your really, really high-end Samsung phone that's going after the likes of the iPhone, the likes of the most expensive HTC and the most expensive Sony and the most expensive LG. So from Samsung, which is the second biggest phone manufacturer in the world, probably in terms of profit, this is a big deal.
It really is. And Jeremy got his hands on with these phones earlier this week. You can read his review and see a few videos of the phone and how it works on wired.co.uk. But in his absence, I'm going to give him an explanation. So the two phones, there's a 5.8-inch and a 6.2-inch, which is pretty standard with a lot of flagship phones. You get an iPhone 7 and then an iPhone 7 Plus, so one smaller, one bigger. There's very little bezel on these phones around the screen. The screen practically runs from one edge to the other on all sides. Samsung's actually removed the home button or the back button, so it's underneath the touchscreen, so there's not a physical button on the phone,
which is so we should stop there. In fact, the most interesting thing about it probably is the lack of a bezel, and this is a trend, if you like, that we're seeing across smartphones and now televisions and laptops and tablets and you name it. Everyone wants this kind of seamless piece of glass that is this window on the world with no bezel around the edge of it. And I think Samsung is something ridiculous, like the front of the phone is now like 85% screen or 88% screen or something like this. And the development in that kind of technology to allow them to do that and to squeeze the screen out that little bit more is very impressive. It looks amazing.
It really does as a phone. Like, the design is admittedly not radically different from previous previous designs of Samsung phones, or even that many other phones that are out in the market now. But you can really tell that this is something that there's been a lot of time and effort put in to make sure that this bezel is really as small as possible. And I think that it's interesting that they did remove that home button or the physical button on the screen, because I think that that's what's been rumored for Apple to be doing and other companies as well.
Yeah, and Apple already kind of did. The button doesn't really exist. Yeah. It's all through the Taptic engine that sits inside the iPhone. But all of this removal of bezel is going to cost you. So the S8 will be £689. The S8 Plus will start at £779.
Very expensive phones.
Very expensive.
But in the same sort of range as other premium flagship phones on different devices. I think the Google phones around that sort of thing, sort of price, and also. So it's obviously the iPhone, but it's not that much different. In terms of its standard specs, it's running Android 7.0. It's got a 10nm octa-core 64-bit processor, which is a mouthful to say. 4GB of RAM, 64GB of memory, which is also expandable with a micro SD card up to 256GB. The battery on the smaller phone is 3000mAh, which I can't remember what that stands for.
Milliamps.
And it's 3500 on the bigger phone. That's pretty high-end stats on everything.
It's what you'd expect. There's a 12-megapixel camera on the back and an 8-megapixel camera on the front. It's also water-resistant, which means that you can drop it in the toilet and fish it out very quickly and it will still work. The specs are fine. They're what you'd expect. Some of the other things that surprised us, a Siri competitor and also a Google Assistant competitor called Bixby.
Yeah, so we talked about Bixby a little bit last week on the podcast because Samsung trailed it as a bit of a sort of look ahead, and it's their competitor for Siri, for Google Assistant, for Microsoft's Cortana, for all the other ones I can't remember. And Samsung, it says they're trying to do this a little bit differently. They're trying to put things into context. They say it's got a cognitive tolerance, which is apparently able to understand a whole sentence rather than just looking for keywords such as an app name or things like that. So it's basically trying to be a bit more contextually aware. One of the really interesting things about this, though, is that Bixby doesn't have the full capabilities of Viv, which is the AI assistant created by the creator of Siri, which then Samsung bought. So it hasn't got the full capabilities of this, which has actually been shown off to be quite a lot more impressive than what is already on there. And one of the things that Jeremy pointed out was that Bixby isn't as good because it needs to be in English, in Korean, and other languages. And it isn't actually launching on the phone at the same time as it does in April. So this the AI assistant is only going to be there from May, so a month later. So it's obviously been a challenge for the company to sort of get this on there. But
you do wonder why Samsung's bothering, really. I mean, Google Home, Google Assistant, Google Now, whatever you want to call it, is now so sophisticated. And I'm not saying that other companies shouldn't try and have a pop at Google. Of course they should. But Samsung's always had this kind of thing of putting its own software onto devices, so you end up with... You'll end up with a Google Assistant and a Samsung Assistant and a Samsung camera app and a Google camera app and a Samsung this app and a Google this app. And it just gets a bit confusing. It's often referred to as bloatware. And some people are a little bit fed up with it. Jeremy, I think, broadly was impressed by the phone.
Yeah,
the phones.
I think he was. He liked them. We're obviously going to do more reviews of this in coming up because we've only had a little bit of time with the phone. So we've not had a huge chance to see it in a real day-to-day testing capability.
You need to spend weeks with these kind of things to really understand how they work. But it needs to work for Samsung. It really needs to be a success. The Note 7 exploding and setting fire to itself was incredibly bad for Samsung's profits. It cost it billions of dollars and really, really damaged its reputation. You can see in the UK now, and I presume around the world, that Samsung's adverts are all about the quality of its testing process. So these robot fingers that push all the buttons and robot buttocks that sit on the phone time and time again. I don't know why I mimed that. Just for you, Matt. So Samsung really needs this one to work. It's been referred to as its most important phone launch ever. Well, until the next one, but it's still a pretty big deal.
It is a big deal. And there was a couple of other things they launched as well. They launched a new 360 camera at the same time. They launched a new controller for the VR headset, the Gear VR headset. And actually one thing that caught Jeremy's eye was a little dock that comes with the with the phone, or I think you can buy it maybe alongside it, called Dex, capital D, small e, big X. And Jeremy described it as a hamburger-sized hub that effectively turns your mobile into a home PC. Basically, the hub connects to a HDMI screen. It doesn't have to be a laptop, doesn't have to be basically anything with a HDMI connection, and you can use your phone on that screen with a Bluetooth keyboard and mouse, and there's a sort of redesigned interface in terms of it being on the screen, which is quite neat, really. Because
yeah, we've been here before, though. There was, I think, Asus, the Transformer book or the something book from a few years ago, and there's been a couple of companies that have given a crack at this. Kind of useful for some people that want to take something from their phone and blow it up onto a bigger screen, so nice to see someone else having a crack at it. Wasn't particularly successful when the companies tried to do it before, but definitely worth mentioning. Our fourth and final story this week. This week, that's my stomach rumbling, I'm sorry. This week saw the triggering of Article 50 in the UK. What does that mean, Matt?
It means doom.
No. I'm biased. What does it mean?
Not necessarily doom. So Article 50 triggering was the start of the negotiation period for Brexit, for the UK leaving the European Union. Basically, we now have on the day when it was triggered, which was, I think, the 28th, Tuesday,
Wednesday,
729 days from then until the UK officially leaves the EU. In that period, we have to negotiate everything from how data is shared between countries to security issues to trade, free movement, everything that is absolutely possible and comes with running a country, really.
It's going to be pretty complicated. They're probably not going to get it all done in 2 years. They've given themselves an awful lot of work to do. But yes, we had this sort of landmark moment for the Brexit movement where the UK's ambassador to the EU handed over the envelope with Theresa May's letter in it to Donald Tusk, the president of the European Union. Would that be his correct title? And it begins. There is literally, I hate the word, but literally there is a clock counting down. I think BuzzFeed made one. You can go and see it online in hours, days, hours, years, minutes and seconds and all this kind of thing. And you'll either want to throw a party to celebrate or throw a party to drown your sorrows. It's going to happen.
It's probably worth saying that a lot of the people that we spoke to for Wired were not particularly optimistic about this in terms of the referendum vote, but there were a few people that were. We've done a few things online around a lot of tech company founders and their sort of views on this and what needs to happen next, and I think it's a mixed bag, but there's obviously a lot of big issues there. And this week, James, you actually were looking at this from a bit of a different perspective, because all of last week you were out in Germany, you were traveling around Berlin, around Hamburg, a few other cities as well, and speaking to startups about what their, and it's not just startups and other businesses, about what their sort of opinions on the UK leaving the EU are.
Yes, so there's this rather large economy in the middle of Europe called Germany, never heard of it. It will now have far more influence over the European Union as the UK begins its exit from the European Union. So, as you said, I went to Berlin, Hanover, Hamburg, and Munich, but to focus specifically on Berlin, because this is where there's a really interesting story developing. Berlin used to be tiny on the startup scene compared to London and Paris and Stockholm and even Helsinki and Madrid and Barcelona and places like this, but now it's really, really catching up. So according to Ernst & Young, Berlin startups raised 2.4 billion euros in venture capital funding in 2015, which is more than London or Stockholm, which for a city that isn't really known for its startups made people sit up and pay attention. So 2 years later, there are now 2,500 startups in the city. I mean, it's quite difficult to count, but that's one number. And around 34% of people employed by startups in Berlin are migrants.
It is. And actually, for people listening, it's where we first met.
It is. Yes. Nice Matt and moment. I met a couple of years ago over a beer in Berlin. So we can both kind of speak from experience of going there quite often. And I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this podcast that either live in Berlin or visit frequently as well. It's a very different city to London. As a consequence, its startup scene is very different as well. But what I found when I visited this time, with a particular focus on the EU referendum, is that there's an awful lot of investment going into Berlin to make it feel eerily like London. So I visited the Israeli-based co-working firm Mindspace, which by the end of the year will have 13,400 square kilometres of co-working space in Berlin. It already has one giant site in Mitte, right in the centre of the city. It's opening a second one nearby in a few months, and another site in Kreuzberg. At the moment, it has capacity for about 700, 750 people. By the middle of the year, it will have room for 2,000 people. And what's really weird about Mindspace is the official language, despite the fact that it's from Tel Aviv and it's in Berlin in this instance, the official language is English. So all the signs on the wall are in English, everyone's speaking English, all of the scrawlings on walls and on whiteboards and on post-it notes is in English, everyone is speaking English. You might as well be in London, but you're not, you're in Berlin.
Yeah, and that's something that isn't particularly unique just to this place. I mean, it's obviously a very big deal, but across the city in general, a lot of people do speak English there. And is it because they're trying to replicate the UK and its success, or is it just because it's easier as a language where more people speak it than German, or it's more universal?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's universal. I think you get this no matter what city you go to. If you go to Stockholm, everyone speaks English. You go to Copenhagen, everyone speaks English. The difference here is that Berlin is making a very deliberate play to try and attract the kind of people that might have come to London from, say, Poland or Spain or Italy or Portugal and to work for companies there. I was speaking to someone the other day who said he'd hired a couple of brilliant software engineers from Italy to come and work in London. Well, maybe Berlin will be able to persuade those kind of people to move there instead, and that London will feel somehow less welcoming. And this is the pitch from Berlin. We're open. Anyone can come here. Everyone speaks English. Come and join our new startup ecosystem, or developing startup ecosystem. So there's another facility I visited. Facility? Building? Factory. It's right by the site of what was once no man's land between East and West Berlin. There's a memorial to the wall right next to it. So it's at this sort of very historic site in a building that used to be a brewery. It was founded 3 years ago, 12,000 square meters of space, and around 2,000 people pay €50 a month for free Wi-Fi, unlimited coffee, meeting rooms, and a chance to sit down at a desk and work in this kind of quite buzzing place. It isn't necessarily somewhere that I could get a lot of work done, but the idea is that you're rubbing shoulders with lots of other people who are creating apps and businesses and website services and startups and yeah, you name it. It's all going on. So there's definitely a buzz in Berlin. It feels super multicultural. It feels really energized by this opportunity that's going to be afforded by London's exit from the European Union.
And it's a lot cheaper as well. And I remember that from our beers that we had. I think that some of the rents are around 700 euros in Berlin versus £1,500 here in the UK per month, roughly for a building.
Yeah, so
that's living, I guess.
A one-bedroom apartment, you can still, I mean, they've been rising. By some estimates, they've quadrupled in the last decade or so, and certainly doubled in recent years. So 700 euros will still get you an apartment in the centre of Berlin, which is, if you say that to someone that lives in London or Paris, they would look at you slightly askance. We're expected to pay around in the region of 1,800 euros to live near the centre of the city. Obviously, you can rent for cheaper further out. Rents in Berlin are on the rise. There's already been a huge influx of people moving there from the south of Europe, a few people moving from the UK and from elsewhere. So it's interesting to see the city responding to these kind of changes. There's an awful lot more building work going on there than there was some time ago. There's an awful lot more investment in terms of venture capital, but also in co-working spaces, in companies moving certain bits of their operations there because they feel more secure being within a country that they know will probably be in the EU for a bit longer rather than the UK, which now has this ticking clock over it. So if you're looking to make an investment, do you do it in London because London has a great scene and lots of support and is sort of the gateway to Europe for a lot of companies? Or do you now think, oh, well, maybe I'll do it in Stockholm or Paris or Berlin?
Yeah, and I think a lot of those reasons and the ones that sort of we've highlighted so far for people moving there or for businesses that want to start up there and grow as well are quite really economic ones in a lot of the cases. But is there anything different that you noticed as well in terms of the way that startups work, the way that businesses were happening, deals or things that were going on there?
Yeah, so there's a criticism of Germany that the money is slower, that venture capitalists are less willing to put in money at seed, which is basically at the highest risk point when a company is very, very young. You're one of the first investors. You stand to gain the most because the risk is so high, but that seed money can be more difficult to get. And when you do get it, it tends to be of a lower amount. These are some of the kind of perceptions of how the startup ecosystem in Berlin and in more broadly across Germany. These are what people tend to think. And you speak to people and that does tend to be the case. They like to go a little bit slower, a little bit more considered. To give one example, Babbel, it's a language learning app and service online You might have used it. It's been around for nearly a decade now, but it's grown very, very slowly. It employs about 450 people in Berlin and New York, but to date, it's only raised $32 million, about 25 million pounds. But that's deliberate. You speak to people who are building businesses in Berlin, even within startups, and while some of them speak about this kind of go fast and break things approach, that sort of Silicon Valley language around things of rapid iteration and innovation, a lot of companies are going, no, we're going to go slowly. We're going to build a business that's credible. We're going to find a way to make profit, and then we'll get the investment, and then we'll scale in a reasonable and responsible way. But without one, so we shouldn't sound like we're just doing an advertisement for people moving to Berlin. There are some big challenges that the city has to overcome and that this ecosystem has to overcome if it's going to be a success. So one of the problems for Berlin, and this was a problem for London until its ecosystem became really well developed, is that companies would grow to a certain size and leave, or that companies would grow to a certain size and fail. And the reason for that is that there's just not enough experience in the city. So you don't have people that can mentor. You don't have these co-working spaces that might have people in them that have maybe on their third or fourth startup. There's just no experience. And Berlin at the moment is a very inexperienced market. So the likes of Babbel and Rocket Internet aside, and Rocket Internet's a whole other issue that we won't get into, there's not really this network of alumni, if you like. Whereas in London, maybe you're trying to start a fintech business, there's all sorts of people that can help you do that. There's all sorts of incubators and co-working spaces and meetings and greetings and get-togethers and all these sort of things. And Berlin is starting to develop that. And it's a process that takes time. So one shouldn't think that just because London's going to be leaving the European Union, that its startup scene will immediately vanish. There are some really good regulatory reasons. There's some really good cultural reasons that London is incredibly successful for that kind of economy. But Berlin, for years, has needed this kind of boost. It's needed something to help kickstart this economy. And the likes of Berlin and Amsterdam and Stockholm and Paris and Barcelona and maybe even Tel Aviv and Helsinki and Dublin all stand to gain because they will have something that London doesn't. And while London will retain lots of things that they also don't have, it won't be in the EU. And for some people, that'll be a big deal.
It really will. And I think that there's obviously so much to play out with London's negotiations, not just London, obviously the UK's negotiations, and whether even Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, etc., have their own referendums and leave, or there's so much that's still up in the air. It's not that London is going to stop or the UK is going to stop being a hub for tech companies. It's still one of the biggest and most powerful economic countries in the world and cities in the world, if you think of London. And there is a lot going on here, and people are still opening offices here, people are still bringing their businesses here and starting businesses, and it's not the end of the world in terms of my doom comment earlier, but I think that there is obviously going to be a chance for other places to capitalize on some of the shortfalls or some of the changes, or
just the uncertainties. You said it earlier, that was a theme that came up time and time again. Lots of people are uncertain, and uncertainty is never good for business or for people's lives. So it remains to be seen. We've got a couple of years to try and work some of these things out. You can read my in-depth report from Berlin on why.co.uk. You can also read about all the stories that we talked about on this week's podcast and lots more jolly good stuff. We'll leave it there for this week for our two-person podcast. We'll have a bigger crew back next week, I hope. But for now, bye-bye.
Goodbye.